Welcome back to Radio Rothbard. I'm Ryan McMakin. I'm a senior editor with the Mises Institute. And here with me, as usual, is Tho Bishop, my associate editor. And let's just talk about Liz Cheney and the whole Bush-Cheney wing of the Republican Party, which just continues to act really, really frightened of what's going on with the Trump wing of the party. And their people are being removed and they're being forced to behave differently in Washington. And whether or not you agree with all the stuff Trump says, or whether you have any emotional attachment to the man, which I don't, but you got to really like the fact that this guy has been great at ending the careers, at least for the time being, of the whole Bush wing of the party. I mean, the humiliation he showered on Jeb Bush, now the humiliation on Liz Cheney, who is defeated in the primary in Wyoming. The one headline I said is that she suffered the largest loss margin in a primary, the second worst in 60 years, and basically just been thrown out of the state. And of course, we can all assume that she will not be setting foot in Wyoming anytime soon, right? Liz Cheney's always been a carpetbagger, never had any connection really to Wyoming. She went and ran for Congress in Wyoming because that's where her daddy could get her a congressional seat, because Cheney actually did have some connection early on in his career to Wyoming. And she thought, hey, where can I be a congressman person from? And an old dick said, hey, Liz, you know, they do what I tell them to do in the Wyoming Republican Party. So just come over here and we'll hand you a seat in Congress and do that. I know, Liz, that you've never actually accomplished anything. I know your whole life is based on your last name being Cheney. But here, you're now a member of Congress. And all you got to do is defend the regime and its wars and the CIA, the FBI, do everything the deep state tells you to do. And you can be a congresswoman forever. But apparently, at some point, either on a personal level or her dad told her, no matter what you do, you got to go down with the ship on hating on Donald Trump. She was willing to just give up her seat in Congress. Not that that's ever going to hurt her personally, right? Her husband's a well-connected Washington attorney, very much in every way a denizen of the swamp in Washington. She'll always have plenty of money. She co-writes books with her father, and she'll always have friends in the millionaire and billionaire wing of the GOP and increasingly with the Democratic Party as well. So she'll always, of course, be fine in that respect. And probably her kids will grow up to be well-connected hedge fund managers and Washington attorneys, and they'll be rich forever because being vice president, being president, means you can basically create a money dynasty for all of your descendants. So that's fine. But the party, I think, sent a message there, just throwing her out. Get out. We're sick of it. We don't need you to lecture us all the time about whether we're moral or not for supporting Donald Trump. So she's really a great example of what's been happening in the party. She's, of course, not alone, right? There have been many other people who have been thrown out of the party. And maybe you, Tho, can just give us kind of a quick summary, like beyond Liz Cheney, of these people have been getting thrown out in the primaries, and kind of what has been sort of the trend here in the GOP primaries in this battle between this populist Trump wing and the old hands in Washington who hate to see it happen.
I'm here stepping in my role as the optimistic young guy trying to paint some silver linings in the American political moment right now, and it's true. Come 2023, for the first time in, 30, 40 years, there will not be a Cheney or a Bush holding political office in America. Because remember, earlier this year, George P. Bush, right, the up-and-comer, the expected next presidential candidate from Texas, he lost his race for attorney general after serving as Texas land commissioner for, I believe, two terms there. He lost with a very similar margin to Cheney. There's about 66-33 within that earlier Texas primary. He won a total of five counties in all of Texas. He got wiped out the first time around. He lost to a man named Ken Paxton, who, you know, definitely had been, you know, building up on sort of, you know, Trump legacy stuff. He was, you know, very outspoken on the election. He was the one that pushed try to get the Supreme Court to act on some of the election stuff and push it down to state level. But he also was dealing with, you know, federal indictments himself, some federal investigations in his own right. So he was not a perfect candidate by any means, and still completely slapped down, George P. Bush, who by all, you know, I think all reports was higher energy than his father, neither here nor there. But if we really break down, what makes the Liz Cheney defeat all the more incredible is that if you look at not only the Republican votes in that race, but the Democrat votes in that race, you had a massive decrease in the number of Democrats that voted in the Wyoming primary. Logic could assume that those people crossed lines into the Republican primary, and still she lost, you know, 66-29 to someone who, again, I'm not going to try to, you know, take the stand that, you know, the replacement of Liz Cheney is going to be that much better, right? You know, she herself, you know, was friends with Cheney back in the day. Of course, if you were at all had any aspirations, you know, you were going to rub shoulders and those things. So I don't want to completely discard her right off the bat. But again, I'm no assumptions here that we're replacing Liz with some sort of Ron Paul of Wyoming type. But it goes just to the rejection that, for one, these old school brands have within the Republican Party. Again, you know, George W. Bush would not be welcomed at any sort of grassroots normal Republican voter event, in spite of being a living Republican president. And then, of course, her, you know, what was her downfall was the January 6th stuff. It was the doubling, tripling, quadrupling down after the 2020 election. Because, again, like the Cheney brand within at least Washington, D.C., was still very high just last year, right? There was an attempt last February to have Liz Cheney, after her impeachment vote on Trump, to keep her as head of the Republican caucus. Within the congressional side of things, she was kept as a party leader, defended by Kevin McCarthy, again, supported by an overwhelming majority of the rank and file House Republicans. And it wasn't until she kept poking this wound that she was eventually kicked out. The people that ran that were, you know, trying to get her removed were vindicated. And now, you know, she's going to be completely out of office, though. She's very well choreographed this. She has the sort of delusional aspirations that you'd expect from a Cheney or a Bush, talking about running for president in 2024. In the meantime, she's going to make a very fine MSNBC anchor. But again, and also to your point about how we should not be weeping for Miss Cheney, there was a fun report that came out last week that showed that her net worth went up 600%. In just the last 3 years alone. That's from the Center for Responsive Politics. That again, in her first term, her net worth was a little over $7 million, and now her net worth is estimated around $44 million dollars. So again, her time in Washington has been very profitable, regardless of anything else. I'm sure she'll be a very fine defense contractor for Raytheon or Lockheed Martin. Maybe that could have some payoff if you have the Trump revenge tour in the future. But yes, ding dong, Cheney is gone. And that, at the very least, is certainly something to celebrate.
Yeah, she might for a while just do the whole professional candidate thing, because that gets you on TV and gets you attention. So sure, run for president in 2024, right? You get to be in the debates and all that sort of stuff. But of course, she has, you don't get thrown out of Congress, have no elected office whatsoever, and then come back and win the presidency. That just doesn't happen. You have to have like this major national base. I guess her approval rating among Republicans is about 14% or so. So she doesn't actually represent anybody, but she knows how to play the power game, as you say. And I just wanted to throw out, this was a good article from the New Yorker about Cheney's kamikaze campaign. And I still don't understand why she's so worked up about defending sort of the old Bush-Cheney brand of the party. I don't see why she thinks that would actually accomplish anything. I mean, you can always just secretly move the levers of power from with, right? I mean, but for whatever reason, this is what she's doubling down on, publicly saying all of these things. But it says, one thing distinguishing Cheney from many other Republicans, Bill Kristol, her friend, went on, was that she did not run for office until her late 40s, and that she had worked long enough at a high enough level in government and national security to understand that elections provided only one route to real power. Sort of like her father, really, Kristol said. Effective office is a secondary thing. Remember that Dick didn't have really any elected offices through, I believe, most of the 80s and 90s, if my memory serves. He was a real high-up guy. Or did he go back to the Senate during the 80s? He was a real high-up guy in, like, the Ford administration, and then he kind of just appeared there in the Bush administration. But he wasn't, like, a real famous out-there guy in that in-between period. And he was mostly working behind the scenes, and he knew how to do that, like a masterful, wield power in Washington without being famous sort of guy. So Liz, I'm sure she's got big plans above and beyond actually running for office. The whole presidential run thing isn't serious except to get attention for herself and maybe to increase her stock in terms of fundraising and such in Washington. But clearly there's a lot in that neocon wing of the party. She's going to be doing a whole lot there. So we haven't heard the last of her. In terms of if you're paying attention to these insiders in Washington, but she may pretty much disappear from the public.
Well, unless she goes back to maybe Virginia, her true home, maybe she could run for Congress over there. I mean, she might be able to even win as a Republican in certain districts of Northern Virginia, given the clientele over there, being very popular with a lot of the lobbyist crowd. I did like, though, with when she gave her sort of ambitious you haven't seen the last of Liz Cheney's speech after her humiliating defeat. She had to compare herself to Abraham Lincoln, and of course Mises Twitter was quick to respond that if Tom DeLorenzo was here, he would be making the same comparisons. That all the things we hate about Liz Cheney are also applicable to old Abe. So that was a good line there. But yes, it is truly an end of an era. And I think what's interesting is that often, we talk about the uniparty, and we talk about how, both parties, work hand in hand. They go in front of Sunday morning news shows and, spar back and forth. The best of them have, a great wit to them that will make it seem very barbed. But then when the cameras are off, right, they go and have dinner and drinks together within very nice D.C. hotels and restaurants. They hang out with the same people. Their staffers are very intermingled, right? Everyone in D.C. hangs out with other people in D.C. unless you're truly an outcast. Honestly, a lot of the Ron Paul staff was. They didn't quite get the same invites as many other staffers did. And, I think that's one of the interesting things here is that even though while it is absolutely true that the majority of Republicans within D.C. are still part of this sort of uniparty mix that we've had for 100 plus years, that there is this growing coalition of legislators and by extension their staffers that genuinely are hated equally by D.C. Republicans and the rest of the Democratic caucus. And that dynamic, again, while we do not want to overstate it right now, because the numbers still are small and growing. You think about a Thomas Massie, you think about a Matt Gaetz, a Marjorie Taylor Greene, a Rand Paul. It's interesting. Ted Cruz kind of, is in this camp, but I don't think it's because of any underlying principles. I think he's just that much of a jerk that, even people even if he plays on their side most of the time, they still don't like him, right? So there's a few kind of people within that camp as well.
Likeable is not a term I would apply to Ted Cruz, yes.
there is a I think this time around, you're going to see within this larger red wave, a group of genuine dissidents. Anthony Sabatini down in Florida, he's got a primary coming up. He's going to be absolutely hated as much as anyone in D.C., you've got this very interesting collection of deeply resentful, Republican people that this resistance wave is going to build. It'd be interesting to see whether that ends up, ever becoming a large enough, true diehard segment of the party to really influence things like leadership races and things like that, right? You don't need to win necessarily the majority of the party to make a difference. You figure most of the people in the Republican Party just kind of go along to whatever will keep their seats. You have a certain group that are genuinely ideologically committed to DC itself. And if you can simply have that margin of dissidents grow large enough that Democrats, you know, the loyal Democrat opposition is larger than the DC coalition of Republicans, that's where you actually have some leverage going on. This is what the Tea Party tried to do and were successful for about, you know, a year and a half, you know, maybe just shy of 2 years, where they had, you know, they were able to get sequestration done by really pressuring Boehner and things like that. A lot of the Tea Party wing, I think, was still extremely naive of politics, right? Most of them would not be calling for defunding the FBI, like a growing number of people are right now. And so there was a naivete with a similar sort of populist wing within 2010. That, I think, is, again, not on the whole, but with on the margins is making a difference here. And that anger, I think, is definitely demonstrated by, again, just the visceral that you had sitting members of Congress had for Cheney, in which Cheney returned, you're right the same way, right? And so again, like this is one of the more interesting elements here, where I think this really has the possibility of really changing what has been a longstanding uniparty atmosphere within, you know, Washington's federal government.
Yeah, I think it's important to emphasize just how unrecognizable the GOP of today, at least the average middle class GOP voter and their groups, how unrecognizable those people would be today to someone who like went into a coma in 2004. A big Republican activist falls into a coma in 2004, and then they wake up in 2021, and they're like, who are these people, right? When I went into a coma, being Republican meant basically worshiping the Washington establishment, the FBI, the CIA, the Pentagon. These people could do no wrong. You were obsessed with terrorists. You signed off on the Patriot Act to give massive new spying powers to the federal government, to basically let the federal government do whatever it wants, because the government protects us from foreigners and bad guys who we're all afraid of. And this idea that the domestic U.S. government could do something to really harm you, and the idea that Washington insiders were against the American people, were enemies of the American people, was completely foreign to real Republican political functioning back in 2004. And it was 100% geared towards supporting the Bush family. And there was really no concern about this idea of the uniparty, and because you had guys like Zell Miller, the Democrat from Georgia, come on at the GOP convention and denounce anyone who didn't support Bush as unpatriotic. So anyone who actually voiced real opposition to the regime was denounced as a terrorist sympathizer. And the administration said specifically, you're either for us, i.e. the Bush administration, or you're for the terrorists. Those are your two choices. And that really just bled out in general. And there was no real criticism of the regime beyond they spend too much money. That was kind of the far too mild brand of dissidence or disobedience that you got out of the Tea Party, right? I think they were starting to recognize some of the problems there, but it didn't really come down to much other than the government needs to limit the amount of spending it's doing, and there's too much deficit spending, and the Federal Reserve is a problem, which, of course, that was progress right there, but there was still so little in terms of recognizing how all of these institutions are deeply against you. But I think maybe that started to come out during the Obama years. You start to see these videos on YouTube and such about how the press would go to these press meetings. What's the annual? The White House Correspondents' Ball, right? And you would watch videos from that, and you had all of these high-ranking American journalists just joking around with the Bush administration personnel, Bush specifically, or with Dick Cheney. They're like literally dancing with Dick Cheney and stuff like that, and you're starting to see, oh, these people are all actually friends. And then you see all these photos of Michelle Obama like hugging and holding hands with George W. Bush, and all of these people coming out of the woodwork, Republicans and Democrats alike, to join together to denounce modern conservative populists today. And so the hatred, I think, is palpable of here we are, rich, wealthy Washington insider types. We hate you Americans that are against the Washington elite. We think you're disgusting rubes and we wish you would all go away. But just keep voting for us and we'll make sure that everything turns out right. So I think people are really only starting to get a sense of how deep the hatred runs in Washington for regular people throughout half of the country.
And it's interesting, if you think backwards to the Bush years, I do think that there was an element of the Democratic backlash to, you know, the war on terror that created a very similar sort of opening on the left. I think this is why you had a lot of libertarians optimistic about kind of, you know, left-wing outreach in much the same way that someone like myself is more optimistic about right-wing outreach now. I know that, you know, Lou Rockwell was criticized by certain sites, you know, for giving a time on his website to, you know, anti-war, you know, leftist people. And it was precisely because you did have this sort of visceral response to the Iraq war from people like Max Cleland, right? If we want to talk about these personal attacks, right? I mean, Max Cleland, who lost limbs in Vietnam, you know, was attacked for being a traitor by, you know, some sort of chicken hawk Republican who you know, never spent a time in service, right? And there was a bit of that sort of old Vietnam guard that was within the Democratic Party that took the war issue, I think, very seriously. Now, unfortunately, most of these people end up falling back, you know, falling in line with, you know, someone like a John Kerry or something like that, right? So you know, they weren't quite the same sort of agitators broadly. Those that refused to kind of fall in line with the Democratic establishment were thrown out as kooks and all that sort of stuff. There was a congresswoman from Georgia that voted against the wars that was completely, you know, shoved out and ended up becoming a Green Party candidate at one time. And so it is interesting how you do have these little pockets within history of a certain moment that will take the anger between members and make it real rather than WWE, you know, kayfabe. But often that isn't backed up with a genuine willingness to take on leadership. And ultimately, if this sort of resentment and passion is going to actually change the government structure as a whole, it must start by genuinely changing the party structure itself. And again, that's why ultimately the success or failure of this, you know, let's call it the America First movement, if they're going to succeed where the Tea Party failed, it's going to be genuinely taking over the leadership positions within the Republican Party, right? You can't have, you know, if you have a small segment of Matt Gaetz Republicans being being led in the Senate by, you know, Mitch McConnell, the changes here is very minimal outside of the great, you know, talking points on you know, great Tucker Carlson appearances and wonderful tweets. Not to take anything away from I think some good votes that Matt Gaetz does, but structurally, right, there's not much there. Ultimately, this is going to have to change the party leadership itself. And of course, you know, one of the great books on how we got to this point is Murray Rothbard's Betrayal of the American Right, where he documents in great detail, you know, how he went from being a New York Republican conservative type, you know, right winger, to seeing how the war factions within the Republican Party were able to be triumphant at the expense of the old right, at the expense of the non-interventionist side. You know, Eisenhower over Taft is kind of one of the moments that he really identifies as his awakening there, which led him to, you know, his own attempts to ally with the new left and creating, you know, really the modern political side of the libertarian movement and yada, yada, yada. It was the corruption of the power centers themselves, because there's all sorts of very interesting research. You know, we had an RGS fellow this year that, you know, did research on, you know, there was still a coalition within the Republican Party of the anti-war right, you know, particularly within the Midwest. The problem is, though, is that they just didn't control, you know, they went out there, they voted good on foreign policy, but they didn't have the ability to really change the party structure as a whole. When most members of Congress kind of follow the leader in that regard, that lead, you know, you have good protest votes, and protest votes are better than bad votes, but it doesn't really get to steer the ship away from the debacles that the American empire has stumbled itself into ever since. And so again, trying to translate this anger into power and you know, let's call it reform, even though I know it's a word that not always has the best of intentions or best implications. It's going to be, can taking down Liz Cheney translate to changes structurally within the leadership of the party going forward? And that is very much an open-ended question at this point.
Yeah, you have to really change the people who are seen as the leaders of the party outside one guy. Again, right, you're still at a very weak position here because you've got Donald Trump. And then how many other people, though, do you have in the party who are real in real positions of power or poised to enter into those positions of power? And that's difficult to see right now. There's still so much of the party that's still controlled by those old Bush-Cheney guys. And one thing that should never be forgotten, right, is how those people are not going to give up their power easily, right? They like being in charge of the party. They want to run their own people. And they will treat anyone who's perceived as an outsider who's trying to change that power structure like garbage. The time period, the only time I was ever like politically active in internal party politics and all of that stuff is I was through like almost no effort of myself, I was elected by the diehard Ron Paul people to be a delegate at the state GOP convention in 2008, which was Ron Paul's first run. So we had our congressional district convention. And then those Ron Paul people were well organized. They had a plan. And so they knew I was a Ron Paul person. So they, next thing I know, I'm a delegate at the state convention. So we're all sitting in there and boy, I was astounded, just absolutely astounded at the way that people treated the Ron Paul supporters at this state convention. It was probably the most vociferous people, the angry people, were the older people at the conference. There was, I remember sitting in the row in front of us was some old woman who was, of course, a McCain supporter in 2008. And there was a young guy next to me who was like, had just gotten out of the military and was a big Ron Paul supporter. So actually kind of a typical Ron Paul supporter, right? A guy who had actually been shot at a war and wanted to change to foreign policy. And boy, this old harpy in front of him just kept shouting at him and treating him like garbage and saying that anyone who doesn't support John McCain is a traitor to the country and all this stuff. That's your Republican Party in 2008. And nothing changed much in 2012 when it was Mitt Romney. And it was all those same sorts of people. All the Ron Paul people were kooks and crazy, and they didn't understand. You need to elect someone like John McCain because he can get things done. Someone like Mitt Romney. Boy, look at what people like John McCain and Mitt Romney are saying nowadays. I'd probably rather have a Democrat in office because then there would be someone to oppose them. If you had Mitt Romney as president right now, we'd all be told to get behind that guy and support a green economy and support whatever latest expansion of Medicaid and Medicare that Mitt Romney wants. That it would just be the center-left party, slightly less left than the Democratic Party. That's what all of these old guards of the party want and have been pushing for many, many years. So when you have like the actual populace show up at these parties, boy, they meet very stiff competition. You're just supposed to play the game and just continue pushing everything toward the welfare warfare state because that gets Republicans elected, they think. And don't dissent. Don't try and change the ideology of the party. Don't have any principles. And then you'll get along fine. But because, boy, those people in power, they don't want to change anything.
When, of course, the people that have no principles are the ones that are wrapping themselves in the cloak of principles. You had a very interesting event recently where Mike Pence, the fine former vice president, he was up in New Hampshire. And, he gave a very serious talking to all of these misguided Republicans that are daring to criticize the rank and file good people of the FBI. And you know what? A chance of defunding the FBI are just as crazy as the calls to defund the police. And any responsible Republican Party that cares about law and order should not be doing anything like that. And for one, it's hilarious that Mike Pence is in New Hampshire. The idea that there is a pathway that still exists for a Liz Cheney, for a Mitt Romney, for a, I think even a Nikki Haley or a Mike Pence that at least had, they can at least point to some time within the Trump club for a little bit. There is no pathway there, right? I mean, the anger and hostility, you know, I bet you if more often than not, the people that were making fun of the Ron Paul people within these large conventions, while a lot of them are still, you know, like, I mean, even here in Bay County, which is plus 43, you know, Trump County, you've got that one, you know, crazy lady in the back that is just so angry that the party that she grew up in, and really that, you know, this has always just been a social club to her, she is just horrified that all these Trumpers are coming in here and questioning the legacy of the Bush family. And you know, she was defending Liz Cheney to the very end, right? You know, there's a few of those that still exist, but those sort of diehard people are the overwhelming minority out there, so much so that at CPAC, they've now split CPAC into events. So this was CPAC, Texas. One of the first things out of Trump's mouth was, you know, he was bragging about some CPAC straw poll, and he was up there. He's like, this is the biggest victory in CPAC history. Thank you for the support. Remember CPAC back in the day? You would have all the Ron Paul people here, and they'd be winning. Ron Paul is a great man. You know, he's odd about a few things, but he's a great man, and his people were great. And then you would have the Bushes, and like they would get mocked. And like, so it's like even Trump is like going out of his way to at least, and only the way that Trump can, you know, have a little tip of the hat to even the Ron Paul crowd, because those people are less, our people are far more within the rank and file of your average, you know, Trump or Republican than the Bush, Cheney, or again, increasingly Pence, Haley folks out there. And again, it doesn't mean much if it's not translated into serious action and political change structurally. But it is interesting just taking the pulse of where half the country is right now. And I don't think the temperature here is going to go down any bit. We were talking about this right before air. You know, there was this extremely illuminating tweet. It started off with an editor at the Financial Times, Edward Luce, who had this comment last week about, you know, I've covered extremism and violent ideologies around the world over my career, have never come across a political force more nihilistic, dangerous, and contemptible than today's Republicans, nothing close. Again, for one, it's important to note here, describing Republicans broadly, it's not like, oh, those crazy fringe Trumpers or those crazy Ron Paul people, than today's Republicans broadly. And last night you had General Michael Hayden, who also served as head of the CIA and the NSA over various presidencies, who quote tweets this and said, I agree, and I was the CIA director. I mean, here's a guy who I believe still has national security clearance, right? Gets all the same perks of all these retired, you know, war criminals and evil people, right? The sort of people that Washington loves nothing more than reward, who is out there actively, basically calling for war with half the country, right? Equating half the country with the worst, you name whatever your preferred a go-to default terrorist group of choice is. He's saying that these Republicans, again, half the country, are worse than those people. And considering this is a man who had no problem drone bombing and torturing some of these people that he now sees as better than, if he had any real power, that would be a very grave statement. And this, of course, is just in a run of these, you know, former national security agency heads, again, all of which are in with good standing within the Biden clique, are within good standing with the Mitch McConnell crowd, right? They are absolute veterans and special members of the reigning uniparty, and they have made it very clear where they stand, and they lack the tact to you know, like, again, you could say this in a DC wine party and get people slapping your back, you know, saying, "Atta boy, you're so right," right? You could go to a New York Times party and get kudos. I mean, these people are saying it publicly because, like, they have no self-awareness here. And I have a feeling that that's not going to do anything to tamper down the flames of political divisiveness. And again, we are setting ourselves up where, again, any sort of trust within American politics is completely out the window. And the scary thing of that is that while that is a great opportunity for those outside of power, which we always have been, right? This creates a very interesting environment for the potential for the sort of, you know, structural change that America has so desperately needed for such a large period of time. The flip side of that opportunity is America has benefited a great deal from a high trust society. America has benefited a great deal from the degrees to which nonviolence and some flawed but existing respect for social institutions, for law, for some sort of these sort of political norms has prevented a lot of violence and bloodshed that you get in other very divisive areas. And why? And so we are seeing all of that be thrown completely out the window again. And for what reason? Because Trump said mean names and made fun of these people. If there's nothing more than that, right? They are willing to destroy the entire foundation of a functioning country to spite this group of people that they can't stand. And again, as people from our position that has long been upset about what we can very easily see as abuses of American power. Again, hopefully this is an opportunity for us to bring to restore some level of governing that is closer to a more liberal, in our sense, society. But they're doing so at the their attacks are not simply focused on those people. They are willing to throw out everyone else to do that. And I don't think these people fully recognize what they're dealing with. I think if you see globally the way that these sort of you know neoliberal you know sort of creatures operate you know throughout the Western world, I mean these are very mediocre, dumb individuals that have no problem locking you up in your house, injecting stuff into your veins, you know, castrating your children, right? I think that you know, they are so detached that they don't recognize what they're building right here, but you know you'd think at the very least you know some of these complete butt kickings by these political dynasties would start getting people to realize, hey, look, you know, maybe the people really aren't with us as much as the comment section of the New York Times would have us believe.
Well, I don't really have much to add to that. I think it's a pretty good summary of of the dangers of the current situation and where it's going. And yeah, where do they think their power base is going to come from then? It's not, it is a system that relies on elections of a fair number of people participating. And it's great that everybody from your DC cocktail party basically agrees with you. But yeah, if they really start to sever themselves from these people, I think part of it stems from the fact that they don't really believe that people are elected to represent a constituency. I saw this a lot in just my years, even working at a state legislature, is there was constantly this feeling among people who were elected by a group of people back in their district that they weren't really there to represent those people, that they were there to vote along what their own personal ideas of what the correct thing to do was. So, and that's often been a debate actually in the scholarship on how our democracy is supposed to function and so on. Does the person who was elected, are they supposed to represent, are they supposed to vote as the people in the district tell them to vote? Or are they supposed to vote in a way that suits their own personal conscience? I'm actually more along the lines of the representative. If you have this lopsided majority of people in your district who tell you to vote a certain way, why don't you do that? Because if you don't do that consistently, you're just going to end up getting replaced, as we're seeing now with Liz Cheney. But Liz, she clearly sees herself as, I'm some sort of beacon of principle and hope, and my votes are actually a way to teach a lesson to these rubes back in my district. And if they throw me out, well, I went down with the ship, but maybe those people learned something. But that's one way of looking at it. But I'm not sure that's a sustainable model when you have primary elections and you do have to actually win elections. You can get away with a lot when you have sort of an electorate that doesn't care or is pretty much in the middle and there's no clear dominant faction within the people who nominate you and elect you. But when you have a state that votes overwhelmingly for Trump and you come back and you try to teach all those people a lesson about how bad Trump is, you're probably going to go down. And go down hard as Cheney did. And that seems to be a lesson that many of these people aren't learning, or they're just so wedded to the idea of I'm the elite and I'm going to teach people back home what the proper views are about things. And it doesn't even occur to them that they might get voted out because they have such a low opinion of the voters back home. But that probably varies by district and how much the voters are paying attention. But I definitely get that attitude from these people. I mean, the way that we get lectured about, are you going to support the FBI? I mean, I guess that's helpful to have Mike Pence out there to tell you who you should oppose. I mean, if Mike Pence tells me to support somebody, I know that group's probably horrible. So I'm glad Mike Pence is out there telling us to support the FBI. I just expose how awful the FBI is and that you should not support them. But for the most part, I mean, who does Mike Pence answer to at this point? Nobody. He doesn't have a constituency. So he's just there pushing the dominant party line and I guess hoping he can ride that to the top of the party and get maybe a presidential run out of it. I don't know.
Yeah, Mike Pence has a handful of big money donors that still lives and says, you know, that they're rich enough to be completely isolated from all this, right? You know, they completely hate the crude form of Trumpism out there, and so they like, oh well, you know, and I could see it like working out like a piece of paper, right? It's like, oh well, here you have someone who can claim all the good things we like about Trump, who is not but still not Trump, and who didn't go along with Trump's super evil scheme to take over the White House with a whole bunch of unarmed protesters, you know, on January 6th, right? And it's like, oh, check, check, check. Problem is, again, like, it's such a disconnect from where people really are. And again, this is something that, again, if you don't hang out with Trumpers, like, it is so easy to fail to recognize, like, how much Trump is kind of a stand-in for them in the way they view things. And so, like, when Liz Cheney went after Trump, it wasn't only that, you know, she went after the former president. I mean, they see it as going after them. Right, they see it as abuses of power that will be used against them, and that fuels this larger discontent, which makes this Trump moment so fascinating. In spite of all the flaws of Trump himself, like the phenomenon there, it is something worth respecting, just because it is yeah, guy, the fact that it's Donald Trump is again still absolutely crazy in so many ways, and but it's real and. Politics is not about what makes logical sense, right? The most important political moment of human history could arguably be, you know, it's Mark Antony giving a speech after the death of Caesar, right? You had legally, you know, those that killed Caesar had legal immunity, you know, technically by the law, yada, yada, it was going to go back to you know, things as went before. But it's the fact that you know, Antony was so able to get the blood pumping of the average people of Rome that you have people rise up, you know, Brutus has to flee the city. I mean, you fall the Senate, right? It's a speech that changed, that ended the Roman Republic. And it's like, there is an emotional element that, again, we can, if we're really interested in policy, if we're really interested in ideology, if we're really interested in any sort of larger, higher-minded values, which is as true for us as it is the left, as it is the centrist, as it is for, you know, those really committed to, you know, what do they call it, the neoliberal world order or whatever it is, you can get so connected to these sort of abstract sort of concepts that you lose sight of the rank and file. And of course, Mises's entire defense of democracy was grounded in that democracy created that sort of pressure valve release, that if the people of a population got so fed up with the ruling class, if the ideology of the representatives so became disconnected from the wants and interests of the people, the democracy allowed for the regime to change without needing the overthrow of standing power. And again, they aren't allowing those. They are slowly closing all of these relief valves and doing so in the name of democracy, of course. But they're closing off these release valves. And again, like, that's we'll see where this thing ends up.
Well, one of my favorite elements of when you read history books and events that involve, say, the overthrow of a monarch or someone who's used to just basically having untrammeled power, it's always funny and fun to read about how they wake up one day and they are shocked to discover that they aren't beloved by the people. You see this, it's among so many monarchs, right? Including most recently, the one I'm thinking of is Pius IX, but you could apply this to any number of Louis XVI also. They all tell themselves, well, if these revolutionaries are such a tiny group, if they ever try and get rid of me, the people will rise up and defend me with their own blood. And that's just a very typical way of thinking, not realizing that a huge portion of the population either opposes them or they're just indifferent, right? They're not going to risk their own neck to defend this monarch who's living far away in opulence. And then, right, the revolutionaries come for them and arrest them. And they're like, where are all my people? My people who love me and who I love. Where are they? Why aren't they defending me? And it turns out most people are like, hey, I'm on the verge of starvation. I'm out here plowing a field. And they're just so out of it. They don't get it. Nobody loves you. No one's defending you. And I get that impression a lot from the GOP leadership, obviously from the Dem leadership also. I mean, Hillary Clinton is absolutely the perfect case of someone who was absolutely stunned to discover she was not beloved when she lost the election in 2016.
But the Russians did it. The Russians had to have been.
I've got to figure out the psychological level. That's why they invent these narratives. I couldn't have lost fair and square. The Russians must have done it because everybody loves me. And I think that is actually part of it. But I think that's what we're facing is a lot of these people in the GOP leadership and in other high echelons of power, they just can't believe. They're still coming to terms with the idea that the people in just the American suburbs hate the people in Washington almost as much as the people in Washington hate those people. And I think that's an eye-opening event for them, for those people in Washington to come to this realization.
And glad that Liz Cheney got to experience that for herself this week.
All right, well, we'll go ahead and wrap up this episode then of Radio Rothbard. Thank you very much for listening. We'll be back again with an episode soon, and so we'll see you next time.